I'm VOA's Jeff Custer with this worldwide news update. Officials in southern Ukraine's Zaporizhia region said Thursday a Russian ballistic missile attack killed at least one person and injured 24 others. Regional Governor Ivan Fedorov reported from his Telegram social media account that Russian drones also destroyed an energy facility and knocked out power to tens of thousands of people. From his Telegram account, Mykolaiv Regional Governor Vitaly Kim said Ukrainian air defenses shot down 9 Russian drones in his region. He said debris from the drones damaged several houses. Speaking Thursday at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte said the situation in Ukraine and the need for NATO allies to step up their defense spending has put the alliance in near crisis mode.
First of all, that we really have to step up and not scale back the support for Ukraine. We have to change the trajectory of the war which is ongoing. And so far, as we know, the front line is moving in the wrong direction.
Rutte said any peace that's achieved in Ukraine must be sustainable. And for it to be sustainable, NATO must make sure that Russian President Vladimir Putin will never again try to get a square kilometer of Ukraine in the future. Israel's military said Thursday it killed 2 Islamic Jihad militants who were involved in a deadly attack on a bus in the West Bank earlier this month. VOA's Tommy McNeil has details.
The Israeli military said Thursday that the 2 men barricaded themselves in a structure in the West Bank village and exchanged fire with Israeli troops before they were killed overnight. The army said a soldier was moderately wounded. The military said that Mohammed Nazal and Katiba al-Shalabi were operatives with the Islamic Jihad militant group. The Hamas militant group released a statement claiming the 2 men were members of its armed wing and praised the bus attack. Hamas and the smaller and more radical Islamic Jihad are allies that sometimes carry out attacks together. Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
This is VOA News. A new wildfire that broke out north of Los Angeles Wednesday rapidly spread to more than 38 square kilometers, fueled by strong winds and dry brush, forcing mandatory evacuation orders for more than 31,000 people. Reuters correspondent Naima Pratton has more.
In just a few hours, the Hughes fire grew to 2/3 the size of the Eaton fire, one of the 2 monster infernos that have ravaged parts of the city. The new blaze put further strain on firefighters, who have almost managed to bring 2 other major fires in the area under control. The California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection said about 1,100 firefighters had been deployed around Southern California, while the LA County Fire Chief said more than 4,000 firefighters were working on the Hughes fire. Rain is forecast from Saturday to Monday, which could give the area some much-needed relief.
That was Reuters correspondent Naima Pratton reporting. A day after he was pardoned along with other January 6 rioters, the founder of the far-right extremist group Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, visited Capitol Hill in Washington, where he minimized his role in the insurrection.
I was commanding my guys. If my guys screwed up, if I'd have been with them, I'd have said, don't go inside the Capitol. But I don't believe they committed any crimes, at most trespass.
At least one Hill staffer not pleased to see him.
You shouldn't be here. You are welcome. First Amendment, free speech.
Right.
It is disrespectful.
No, it's not.
Here. Congressman Eric Swalwell, a California Democrat, offered this.
Donald Trump does not back the blue. He backs the coup.
House Speaker Mike Johnson says he won't second guess the president's decision.
You know, it's kind of my ethos, my worldview. We believe in redemption. We believe in second chances.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
Rhodes was convicted of seditious conspiracy in one of the most serious cases brought by the U.S. Justice Department in the siege that halted the certification of President Joe Biden's 2020 election victory and left more than 100 police officers injured. A group known as Aviation Sans Frontiers, or Aviation Without Borders, has announced it's using a new, larger, more powerful drone, not for warfare, but for missions delivering acutely needed humanitarian aid to hard-to-reach areas of Central Africa. The new unmanned aircraft can stay aloft for up to 9 hours, flying up to 1,000 kilometers day or night while carrying a payload of up to 150 kilograms. It needs only a short runway to operate. One of the group's operators, Benoit Gavary, said using the drone keeps aid workers safe while getting desperately needed aid into remote war-torn areas.
The access of the population, the risk of the aid worker is increasing every day. You have some example in Mali, in Burkina Faso, or in Niger. Or 10 years ago, we can access with the aircraft. No, at the moment, we use a helicopter for that. They have a landing for 5 minutes on ground, and they need to go back because the security is not controlled, is not safe.
The British-made drones are also currently in use in Ukraine, Britain, and the U.S. That wraps up this news update, but the world and the news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Misleading information about Mpox has the potential to erode public trust, delay health-seeking behaviors, and fuel stigma against those affected, unfortunately.
That's Abdurrahman Diallo, the World Health Organization representative in Kenya, on the need to dispel myths surrounding Mpox outbreak. Details coming up. Also, a new study indicates China's Africa policy is aimed at creating dependencies to support Beijing's global ambitions. And the U.S. withdrawal from the World Health Organization could foreshadow funding cuts for other U.N. agencies. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. As Mpox cases continue to spread across Africa, Kenyan health officials say they have implemented a raft of preparedness and response measures to swiftly detect and halt the viral disease's advances. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
Speaking Thursday to reporters in Nairobi, health officials noted the rising number and geographic spread of Mpox cases, especially from the clade 1B variant of the virus. Mary Muthoni Muriuki is Kenya's principal secretary at the State Department of Public Health.
Regarding the current situation in Kenya, Mpox remains a very, very big threat, not just in Kenya, but the East Africa region. In the past 1 week, we have confirmed 5 new cases. This brings the total number of Mpox cases in the country to 36 from across 12 counties.
Kenya, along with Burundi, Rwanda, and Uganda, have confirmed cases of the clade 1B Mpox variant, which was first detected in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and is thought to be more severe and transmissible than earlier variants. The rapid spread of clade 1B was part of the reason the World Health Organization declared the Mpox outbreak a public health emergency of international concern last August. With support from the WHO and other partners, Kenya has developed an Mpox National Preparedness and Response Plan. The plan has identified high-risk counties along the Northern Corridor, a busy transport route from the Kenya-Uganda border to the port city of Mombasa, and rapid response teams have been deployed to intensify surveillance. Luigi Aquino is the chief of health at UNICEF in Kenya.
The caseload of Mpox in the region is very high. We are more and more exposed to acute events, which can be outbreaks or other emergencies. And I think the role of all of us is going to be crucial for a very simple reason. Disease do not spare children. And as a United Nations Children Fund, we are here to help promoting and protecting the rights of children.
As Mpox cases rise across the continent, public health experts say more needs to be done to dispel myths surrounding the outbreak. Abdurrahmane Diallo is the WHO representative in Kenya.
While strides have been made in controlling the disease, one of the most persistent challenges we face is the battle against misinformation and disinformation. Misleading information about Mpox has the potential to erode public trust, delay health-seeking behaviors, and fuel stigma against those affected, unfortunately.
Some of the myths say Mpox only affects people in certain regions, such as the eastern DRC. Other myths involve conspiracy theories about the vaccine recently developed to fight Mpox. The United States is among major donors that have committed billions of dollars to support the global response to the Mpox outbreak. Mpox cases have also been found in Sweden, Thailand, the United Kingdom, Belgium, Canada, and the United States. The patients had recently traveled to Africa. Mpox is an infectious disease caused by a virus transmitted from animals to humans, with cases often found close to tropical rainforests with animals that carry the virus. It can also spread from humans to humans through close physical contact. In some cases, it can be fatal. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Nigerian authorities said this week that the nation's new partnership status with the BRICS bloc could unlock critical opportunities in trade, investment, and agriculture. Nigeria officially became a part of the international economic and political bloc last Friday. But analysts caution that the country must address significant economic challenges to fully benefit from the potential new markets. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Nigerian President Bola Tinubu's special advisor, Daniel Bwala, told Lagos-based Channels Television that the partnership is pivotal to promoting trade and investment, food security, infrastructure development, and energy security. Bwala said the pact enables Nigeria to forge deeper strategic relationships with BRICS members beyond traditional bilateral partnerships. BRICS, an acronym for the founding member nations of Brazil, Russia, India, China, with South Africa added a year later, is a political and economic bloc aimed at fostering mutually beneficial relations among its members. BRICS introduced the so-called partner country category in October, which is a step below full membership. Economist Emeka Okengwu says Nigeria stands to benefit from BRICS, but highlights some critical areas of focus.
Look at the members of BRICS and look at the economies that they bring to the table. Brazil is probably the biggest producers of livestock and its allied products globally. They are into aircraft, aviation, and renewable energy. Look at Russia. Look at India. Okay, let's look at China. Let's look at South Africa. And I think there's Egypt and Ethiopia. Vis-a-vis population, if you put them together, they probably bring 10 times the value of whatever other markets Europe and America can give to you.
All 10 BRICS member states represent 40% of the global economy and account for approximately 55% of the global population. In a statement, Nigeria's Foreign Affairs Ministry said that the country's participation in BRICS reflects its commitment to leveraging global economic opportunities to advance national development goals. Last December, Nigeria intensified efforts to join not only BRICS, but also the G20 and the BRICS New Development Bank. Okengwu explains how Nigeria can take advantage of these opportunities.
Being productive, taking goods and services in there, being able to meet global standards and being competitive. It would have been horrible if Nigeria, you know, was not in that BRICS and they would have been left hanging with all these challenges we're having with our neighbors from the Sahel.
Despite the optimism, analysts say Nigeria faces significant hurdles. The country's struggling economy and inadequate infrastructure raise concerns about its capacity to drive meaningful growth through BRICS. There's also concern about how Nigeria will balance its alliances with Western nations while deepening ties with BRICS. However, Ndung Okolo of Next Year suggests this challenge is manageable.
It's about how smart you are to benefit from everybody. With what we are seeing by some of the pronouncements of the President Trump, Nigeria may benefit from it because already Trump is talking about increasing taxes even within allied states. So if he's going to do that with countries that we think are his traditional partners, so who is telling you that you will not he will not do more with countries that he considered outsiders? So we are looking at a situation where countries that are not originally traditional allies of America will try to pull together, and Nigeria may benefit from that.
Analysts agree that Nigeria's entry into a BRICS partnership could redefine its economic trajectory, but many will be watching to see how and if the country can fully exploit its opportunity. Timfi Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
A new study by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies indicates that China's Africa policy is part of a global strategy to create dependencies and interdependencies that make countries and regions more inclined to support Beijing's global ambitions. Africa-China relations in 2025 kicked off with a visit by China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi earlier this month. Paul Nanatulia, the author of the study, discussed China's objectives in Africa with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy, starting with its diplomatic and political objectives.
This report makes a strategic forecast of what China-Africa relations are going to look like in 2025. Very important, given that the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation, the Ninth Summit, met in Beijing last September. And so the program that came out of that summit is now being implemented. Part of the reason why the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi recently visited four African countries. The first is China is looking for allies. China is looking for partners. China is looking for countries that can lend it the diplomatic support that it needs at the international level. China is contesting global leadership in various multilateral institutions, and the support of African countries becomes extremely important because of the numbers. Africa is the largest region in the global south diplomatically, and it also has, numerically, it has the most votes in crucial international institutions like, the UN General Assembly and others. So China really prioritizes that diplomatic support because it becomes critical in pushing Chinese interest and Chinese global stances on a number of issues. So China has a diplomatic interest investing heavily in building these bonds of solidarity and affinity.
Walk us now through the second objective for China and the African continent.
China is building an international architecture of economic arrangements and economic entanglements, trade corridors, and special economic zones, in part to stimulate the Chinese economy, but also to increase China's global economic influence. So economic entanglements and engagements are a critical part of Chinese statecraft. China is the continent's largest trade partner, and the trade volumes between African countries and China have consistently remained high, even during the COVID years. And that is critically important for Chinese strategists, because it means that when African decision makers are making decisions and calculations about their international partnerships and about China, China is accorded a certain level of deference because of the trade volume. Now, we can talk about the nature of that trade. Certainly, African countries continue to export raw materials and unprocessed goods and import manufactured products from China, and that accounts for the large trade deficit, and that is a problem that many African countries are articulating. But nevertheless, the trade volumes are on an order of magnitude that disincentivizes African countries from not pursuing robust relations with China.
Paul, in your study, you mentioned that security, military, and law enforcement constituted the third objective for China in Africa. Can you explain why?
Security, military, and law enforcement don't occur in a vacuum. They occur within the larger logic of Chinese statecraft. So when it comes to things like anti-piracy, counterterrorism, and things of that sort, the large economic footprint of Chinese state-owned enterprises also come with security risks. Now, there are over 10,000 Chinese firms on the continent engaged in different sectors. Chinese state-owned enterprises account for over 60% of Africa's tenders for major construction, public works, hydropower stations. And in fact, the revenues in construction alone that Chinese state-owned enterprises gain on an annual basis is actually larger than China's total foreign direct investment into the continent. So this presence within African economic sectors is strategically important for the People's Republic of China. It comes with security elements. China has been increasing its security packages for the African continent. Major announcements were made at the summit in September, and we have seen even during Wang Yi's his visit, the issue of increasing the numbers of African officers that are sent to study in Chinese military academies. The figure now stands at 6,000. That's quite significant because no other industrialized country trains those numbers of African military professionals. So when we look at the economic side, when we look at the military side, security, law enforcement, perhaps even intelligence cooperation, all these are part of a larger mix that is aimed first and foremost at securing Chinese interests and ensuring that African countries continue to be willing, able, and capable to identify Chinese interests and in some cases to even defend Chinese interests.
That was Paul Nanatulia, the author of the study, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. We'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. Chad's Constitutional Council has ignored opposition calls to set aside the results of last month's parliamentary elections for gross irregularities and fraud and proclaimed the ruling party of Chad's president, Field Marshal Mahamat Idriss Deby, the winner. Officials say nominations for senatorial elections to end the transition are open, but the opposition insists another transitional government should be formed and transparent elections organized to end the three-decade-old Deby family rule. Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
Officials in Chad say opposition leaders assembled Wednesday in the capital, N'Djamena, to protest legislative election results published Tuesday by the Constitutional Council, the Central African nation's highest court. Clement Sianka, spokesperson of Chad's National Assembly of Democrats, an opposition political party that participated in the December 29 polls, says he took part in the protest because his party is surprised that the council refused to annul the elections marred by fraud, low voter participation, and intimidation of civilians Chad's military considered to be opposition supporters.
Si vous regardez les candidats, les partis politiques n'ont droit à aucun procès.
Sianka says by ordering government troops to chase opposition party representatives from polling stations, Chad's president Mahamat Idriss Deby, who in December declared himself as Field Marshal, the highest rank in Chad's military, once more sent a strong message to civilians that he wants to take power at any cost and continue the three-decade rule begun by his father, Idriss Deby Itno. According to the final results published by the country's Constitutional Council Tuesday, the MPS won 124 seats in the 188-member National Assembly. 64 women were voted in as lawmakers, according to the official results, an increase of 36 women over Chad's last legislative period, which ended in 2011. Chad says financial difficulties had made it impossible for legislative polls to be held since 2011. The opposition says the polls, the first in over a decade, should be set aside because most of Chad's roughly 8.3 million voters heeded opposition calls for a boycott. There were no indications the polls were to be free, fair, and transparent, as civilians already knew that Deby wanted to confiscate power, Chad's opposition says. However, Chad's Constitutional Council says voter turnout was over 50% and the elections were peaceful with no major incidents that could affect the outcome of polls. Chad's Political Actors Consultation Group, or GCAP, a coalition of several dozen political parties, on Wednesday said democracy was stifled during Chad's three-year transition period. GCAP says Deby, who took power as a military ruler in 2021, persecutes critical opposition leaders to maintain the rule of his father, longtime President Idris Deby Itno's rule. Idris Deby spent 3 decades in power until he died while fighting rebels in April 2021. Chad's Constitutional Council has neglected calls for an immediate end to the country's transitional government and the cancellation of the December 29 elections. The council says such calls are intended to bring chaos in Chad. Chad's opposition has always contested the outcome of elections since Deby became transitional president. Deby says he respects the verdict of the ballot and calls on civilians to work with democratically elected officials for the development of Chad. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Following President Donald Trump's announcement that the U.S. will withdraw from the World Health Organization, the United States is expected to reduce funding to other U.N. agencies. As White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wida Kuswara reports, other wealthy nations are unlikely to fill the gap.
Lean times are ahead for the United Nations as the United States withdraws from international commitments, including its membership in the World Health Organization. WHO spokesperson Tarek Jasarevic.
It was 18% of the budget in 2023. And as I said, the U.S. is the largest single donor.
On Monday, his first day in office, President Donald Trump signed various executive orders, including one to exit the U.S. from the U.N.'s Paris Agreement, an international climate accord.
The United States will not sabotage our own industries while China pollutes with impunity.
The U.S. is the world's biggest producer of fossil fuels that cause global warming. It's also the largest financial contributor to the U.N. In her Senate confirmation hearing Tuesday, Trump's nominee for U.N. Ambassador Elise Stefanik said that the children's agency UNICEF and the World Food Program are effective U.N. agencies. However, funding for others will be cut, including for UNRWA, the agency that helps Palestinian refugees.
Our tax dollars should not be complicit in propping up entities that are counter to American interests, anti-Semitic, or engaging in fraud, corruption, or terrorism.
When Trump reduced funding for many UN agencies in 2017 during his first term, European Union countries stepped up financially. But now they're focused on defense spending to help Ukraine push back against Russia's invasion, in part because of Trump's skepticism toward aid for Kyiv, French President Emmanuel Macron.
Now that the new administration in the United States has taken office, it is more important than ever for Europeans, for our two countries, France and Germany, to play their full part in consolidating a united, strong and sovereign Europe.
Meanwhile, China is unlikely to expand its UN funding, said Richard Gowan, UN director of the International Crisis Group, via Skype.
Chinese officials are also realistic that their country is facing some economic headwinds, and they don't have lots of spare money to throw around. So I'm afraid that there is no obvious alternative funder for the UN to turn to.
This is the second time Trump pulled the U.S. out of the 2015 Paris Agreement that aims to keep global warming below 2 degrees Celsius from pre-industrial levels by slashing planet warming carbon emissions. Trump's successor in 2021, President Joe Biden, had the U.S. rejoin the Paris Agreement on his first day in office. Analysts said shifting U.S. positions may make other countries take their climate commitments less seriously. Sheila Olmsted, Cornell University professor who studies the economic dimensions of environmental policies, via Skype.
We have less emissions reduction in China or less emissions reduction, right, in other countries of the world. Those countries, right, failing to reduce emissions as a part, right, reflecting on the U.S. example, will create damages that will affect the U.S. economy, right? The damages are global.
Climate activists protested Trump's decision. Once the withdrawal takes effect next year, the U.S. joins Iran, Libya, and Yemen as the only U.N. countries not part of the climate agreement. Patsy Wida Huswara, VOA News, Washington.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Jumbe Hamza, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.